Hello, everybody. Welcome to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and this week we actually have Russ Chianelli with us again. And we have a guest who's going to be talking about science and the role of science at the moment in his particular area of trying to cure cancer. But this is a fellow that started out as a track star, discovered chemistry, went away and became a big professor of chemistry. Then he became a dean. Now he builds windmills in Belize. He does a wonderful range of things. Who is this man?
We're very happy to have with us this time on Science Studio Dr. George McClendon, and he's the Dean of the Faculty of Arts and Sciences and the Dean of Trinity College at Duke University. George, welcome to Science Studio.
Thanks, Russ, and thanks, Keith.
It's great to have you here. So, as usual on this program, before we get into the nitty-gritty of curing cancer or whatever it is we're going to talk about, a little bit about George. How did you get into this science game?
I wasn't really a science guy in high school other than this sort of wonderful things that you realized you could do if you made nitrogen triiodide. That was a great thing.
And for the lay public out there, you can sprinkle this on the floor that when people tread on it, it just minor little explosions.
But other than that, I really didn't pay much attention to science in high school. I was more interested in social sciences, poli-sci, things like that. Did my junior year abroad as a freshman in Munich. And I think the main things that I learned were that Winkelgeschwindigkeit was rotational velocity, and I majored sort of in Fasching, which is the Mardi Gras of southern Germany. So I came to UTEP really in my sophomore year with the idea of paying special attention to the kind of athletics that I was interested in, which were middle distance running. And UTEP was a great school for track at that time. But got waylaid one day in the library. I was working on a poli-sci paper, which was going to be my putative major, and found sitting on the table a book by Isaac Asimov. Many people think of Asimov as a science fiction writer, but he wrote much more nonfiction. And this was a book called Asimov on Chemistry that told about how elements were discovered and how many people died trying to discover these elements. I thought this was just fascinating. So I decided that I should take a chemistry course because I never had. I went into the office of the department at the time. I think that Whalen may have been the chair at that time. I'm not sure.
He was. Bill Whalen was the chair.
But it turns out that they were just uncommonly nice when I said, well, I would like to take chemistry. I'm a sophomore. My friends are all taking organic chemistry, so I guess that's the course I should take. And they said, well, how did you do in freshman chemistry? And I went, what's that? And they said, well, how did you do in high school chemistry? And I said, well, I didn't actually take high school chemistry. And so this clearly was going nowhere, and they were having a hard time getting rid of me. And I said, well, there must be some way to get in this class. How much prerequisites can you honestly need? So Dr. Whalen came up with the idea, I think, I assume it was him, that if I would just take the final exam from the freshman course and if I got a sufficiently good grade, they would allow me to matriculate in organic chemistry. So they gave me the textbook for the freshman course. I went home and for the entire weekend did nothing except read the book and do the problems. And I came in, and apparently I did quite well on the exam because they let me take organic chemistry.
It would be interesting to figure that out. Maybe they never even corrected it. Okay,
they actually gave me a grade. I just won't go into what it was. But although Keith will have an opportunity to dispute this because he has more appropriate data, in some ways I was intellectually well-suited for chemistry. I could think geometrically, which is what chemists have to be able to do. I was pretty comfortable with numbers, so the physical chemistry part didn't bother me at all. I just liked it, and I really got excited about it. So it was a great time to be an undergraduate at UTEP in chemistry. And the reason was that there was sort of this three musketeers of people who at that time were really very young faculty. There was the young sort of quirky English Keith Pannell who would wander around the playgrounds while my friends and I were out there in various states of dislocation.
Let's get on to a little bit of what you're doing these
days.
I think we can just
we will invite you back for another show about Keith's youth. I think that would be very interesting.
Yeah, and
but actually, I will avoid that since clearly you want me to avoid that.
Not at all.
I will say that it was fun There were sort of the three musketeers. There was Keith, there was Mike Eastman, and Mike Davis. They were all very research active. There really weren't any graduate students to speak of, a master's student here or there. And so they went out of their way to find the undergraduates who were excited about chemistry and get them into the labs.
One of the other fellows in the lab with you in my lab was Jeff Cassius,
right,
who went on to work with Rickover in the nuclear submarine program and just retired last year as Rear Admiral. So amazing kids back then.
But did all this help you in producing the nitrogen triiodide?
Of course not.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Oh, well, but I didn't know that part.
It was fun.
Let's get on to what your career has been. I mean, you're basically what we call an inorganic chemist that went into the bioinorganic area.
That's right.
Did a lot of work with electron transfer, which is very important in biological metal protein systems. But let's jump right to what you've been doing in the last few years, where you've moved into this business of using chemistry to try to tackle one of the big diseases, and that is some form of the cancers. Why don't you sort of put it in perspective for us? What made you get into that? What do you find interesting? What are the problems? And what solutions have you come up with?
Okay. Well, there were a couple of things that happened roughly simultaneously. Nothing's ever perfectly simultaneous. One was that I had published a couple of hundred papers, many of which were in the general area of trying to understand how an electron gets from one place to another place, which is the essence of chemistry. This was pretty detailed quantum mechanical kind of stuff. And it was starting, in Yogi Berra's famous phrase, to look like deja vu all over again. My personal favorite protein was a protein called cytochrome C, which was kind of a small protein. It was structurally very well characterized. It was genetically very well characterized. It was about as close as biology was going to get to a hydrogen atom problem. And so
Is its importance for our audience?
It moves electrons around in your mitochondria. Your mitochondria are your little energy factories. Without those, you can't run. And cytochrome C is part of the so-called electron transport system, which basically means it's like a biological battery. It moves electrons from a high-energy place to a lower-energy place, and that energy is then released to do things like make proteins or build nucleic acids or build strong bodies five ways, whatever it is.
So it stores an electron, brings it over here and gives it and goes back and gets another one, something like that.
That's exactly what it does. And so I was at that point one of the world's experts on cytochrome C, not because I knew anything particularly special, but because everybody else who was an expert had either retired or died. And so at about that moment, when I was wondering why I was continuing to do this stuff, there was an extraordinarily brilliant young scientist, a guy named Xiaodong Wang. At that time was at Emory. He's now at UT Southwestern Medical Center, who had discovered that cytochrome C did something else, that it was also the messenger of death, which told cells that had been mutated and were becoming, your time is up. Go ahead and jump. So it became very important to have somebody that had all the knowledge about the structure of this protein, its reactivity, its detailed interactions with other proteins to understand how it carried out that mission. And so I became interested in how cells decide whether or not to die. In essence, cancer is a failure of that cell death mechanism.
Means that they continue to reproduce and they should be cut out.
Yeah, they're basically like vampires. They should die. They have no reason to stay alive.
The living dead.
They are the living dead. So what we were going to try and do was figure out how to use that knowledge to help them to their final resting place.
But let me back up a little bit. So you're a cytochrome C, and your job is to give something, to an electron to somebody. And it comes up and it decides, well, wait a minute, you're over the limit?
No, actually it does something stranger, which is cytochrome C is packaged inside this little mitochondria, which has a little fence around it that separates it from the rest of the cell. So it lets energy in and out in the form of—
It's a gatekeeper for energy.
It's a gatekeeper for energy. If cytochrome C ever gets out of that little fenced area, it then finds another protein that it normally would never see. And when it binds to that other protein, all sorts of proteins start coming together and self-assemble like a transformer. and they turn into a different structure called an apoptosome. It's a huge complex of multiple proteins. And that then is a factory that can take otherwise inactive proteases. Proteases are just proteins that chew up other proteins. They're the things that you find in Adolf's meat tenderizer, for example. And it activates those proteins, and then they start to chew the cell up from the inside out. And that's how cells commit suicide. The wonderful thing about that, there's a different way they can die called necrosis, which is messy and creates
so
all sorts of problems.
Apoptosis?
This is apoptosis.
Okay.
In fact, it's either apoptosis or apoptosis. Whether you pronounce the other P depends on whether you're from a group that believes that pterodactyl is pterodactyl or whether you're from a group that believes that helicopter is helicotter. So that's the way that these things work. And we wanted to understand that first step in that process.
Well, you said one thing that you know, the cytochrome is usually in the mitochondria, and if it gets out, can you talk about that a little bit, if it gets out?
So if it gets out.
I mean, is that an accident, or is it designed that it might?
Well, nothing in biology is ever a pure accident. These are very highly regulated processes, and they have to be, because if none of your cells ever die, you turn into a giant tumor. And if all of your cells die, you disappear. And so you want to be at some place in between in terms of that process. And that means that there's lots of levels of regulation. So one of the levels of regulation is all the way back at the DNA. Let's say, like me, you're an Anglo and you've hung out in the sun too long. A sunburn is basically nature's way of telling you you have mutated your DNA. And so you're going to try and slough off that skin because it's mutated, and if you don't, you're likely for it to turn into a tumor. And so that involves this apoptosis pathway. So what happens? What you've done is you've mutated some piece of DNA somewhere. You might have made a thymidine dimer.
So if there's a mutation and something happens to the mitochondria and these things now
That's
come out.
Exactly it. Okay. If there's a mutation, the P53 protein signals another protein, which signals another protein, which tells the mitochondria, let out the cytochrome C. The cytochrome C comes out. After that, all hell breaks loose.
Now that was all known before you got into this from this fellow Wang.
That was known sort of simultaneously when I got into it. I actually read this paper and called Wang up and said, this is really fascinating stuff. And by the way, I have point mutations of every amino acid in cytochrome C. So if you want to know which ones are important, we could collaborate on this and figure out how these things actually interact. So I had point mutations of every amino acid in cytochrome C, and that enabled us to figure out how these things bound, how tightly they bound. It turns out that they bound so tightly that one protein per cell was enough to ensure that they were totally bound. It wasn't an equilibrium. It was an irreversible signal. And an irreversible signal didn't sound good. It meant there was no way to put the brakes on. So if any cytochrome C had ever if one molecule had leaked out, and if you think about what's the free energy gradient between 0 and 1, it's infinity. And so you can't have an infinite free energy gradient. That doesn't work. So you had to have a different way to put the brakes on. We started looking for what it was that put the brakes on, and that's the next part of the story.
We'll be back. That's very good. We'll take a short break here. This is Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, George McClendon talking about cytochrome C and its activity, and we'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. So you know how some people can't say no to pizza and others will pay top dollar for sushi?
So you're the pizza guy and I'm the sushi man.
Hey, I happen to like both, but some people don't. We each possess unique food preferences, due largely to our sense of smell, which is defined by our genes.
Scientists have been sorting out just which genes are responsible, and up until recently, only several had been identified. For example, our perception of the herb cilantro is picked up by one olfactory receptor, while grassy odors are linked to another.
Now we're also learning each of us experiences the same odor differently due to genetic variances. Scientists tested nearly 200 people for how well they identified 10 different chemicals. Then each person's genome was sequenced so that the scientists could later track the genetic variants that influenced how people reacted to specific odors.
After analyzing the results, researchers linked clusters of genes for 4 of the 10 chemicals. These chemicals are associated with odors found in apples, blue cheese, and violets.
So take one chemical, beta-ionine, which is behind a violet's fragrance. People with two insensitive gene variants for beta-ionine either couldn't detect the floral note or found it pungent.
This tells us people can have vastly different appreciations for the same meal. One day, imagine carrying an olfactory profile to dine at a restaurant whose chefs then prepare a meal to your exact preferences.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, and George McClendon. We're talking about cytochrome C and its ability to sort of intercede and perhaps be a cure for cancers. So, George, carry on with the thought.
So we'd gotten to the point where you had mutated DNA. The cell recognized that the DNA was mutated, sent out little messengers to see first if they could fix the mutation, and then if they couldn't, they sent a messenger to the mitochondria in the energy factory of the cell and said, let cytochrome C escape, because if it escapes, then the cell can die.
So this is a vampire hunter. Really.
This is the vampire hunter, as it were.
So the question would be then—
This is Buffy.
The question then is, I guess you're going to say next, is why doesn't it recognize the cancer tumor?
Actually, I wasn't going to say that, but it's a very good question. And I'll come back to that in a moment.
Okay.
So let me just say what happens next. If one molecule of cytochrome C were enough to cause this to leak out, then too many cells would die. And so there has to be something to put on the brakes. And these are called inhibitor of apoptosis proteins. But if they get overexpressed, it turns out cancer cells are very good at figuring out how to keep themselves alive. And so one trick that they use is they overexpress these inhibitors. And the inhibitors inhibit these proteases that chew the cell up. So you have to have something ultimately to inhibit the inhibitors. It's a little bit like having these nested Russian dolls, and you take one out and there's another one inside, and you take one out and there's another one inside. Realizing what the inhibitor of the inhibitor was actually the breakthrough that led towards the clinic. There's a protein that the Princeton and Dallas groups called the second mitochondrial activator of caspase, SMAC. It wasn't a very clever name. It was actually, I think, discovered first by an Australian group from a very good friend of mine, David Vo, who's a brilliant guy. And he spent weeks trying to figure out a good acronym. It was the death-inducing apoptosis. It spelled out Diablo.
Wonderful.
Which was
so
great.
This could be the cytochrome C smackdown.
It turned out we published first because he spent too long trying to figure out the acronym.
Oh, you didn't know that they were working on it simultaneously?
We did not know that. Neither of us knew that. There are many things interesting about this protein. It's a big protein. It has all kinds of special things that it did. But from my perspective, the most special thing was the first four amino acids. And it turns out the first four amino acids, when the structure was done by my Princeton collaborator, Yigong Shi, when I was at Princeton, we realized that all the rest of the protein wasn't doing much directly. It interacted with other factors. But the first four amino acids were enough to make everything work. And why that's interesting if you're a chemist is that's a small molecule. So while they were working on how this related to the genetics of Drosophila, I was off in the lab making those four amino acids and seeing if those alone were enough to help a cancer cell die. And it turns out they were. And so that's in medicinal chemistry what you call a lead molecule. And once you have that lead, you can start making variations on that lead and see if you can make molecules that are more and more and more effective. And so we started making more and more molecules, and we got molecules that were more and more effective.
On just small ones of four units, or are you getting to bigger units of six, seven?
It turned out that the most effective thing to do, for reasons that are complicated but fun, was that if you took just those four units and then you dimerized them, that turned out to work hundreds of times better than just the four units by themselves.
And you dimerized them head-to-head or head-to-tail? So they're symmetrical from outside, or?
These were head-to-tail dimers.
Okay.
those are the best candidate drugs at this point. And what you could do was show that these helped cancer cells die over and over again, and they had almost no effect on normal cells.
And any cancer cells? Or the,
just about any cancer. They work in all kinds of different tumors.
Can you describe that a little bit? I mean, we do these kinds of tests here, too, when we have colon cancer cell or breast cancer. Do you just have a whole array of them?
You have a whole array of them. Cancer cells are immortalized. I mean, they should have died already, and they haven't.
Right.
And so they're often pretty easy to grow in culture.
Yeah.
And so you can have lots of little petri dishes with different cancer cells on them. You can make arrays of those so you can look at hundreds at once. And you can add
So this is what you do with these leaders.
That's what you
leaders.
Do with these things.
Okay, so then you have to determine that they're better, they don't kill the regular cells.
Right.
And also that the death is by apoptosis.
Yep, and all of that's pretty easy to do microscopically. You have facilities in the new biology building that can do this kind of thing extraordinarily well with a high degree of automation. But you really don't know much until you get into an animal. Once you've shown that you kill cancer cells and you don't kill normal cells, you have to go into an animal because killing cancer cells alone is pretty easy. Cyanide actually works really well.
But then it doesn't do, say, apoptosis, though, doesn't it?
No, then it just kills everything.
Yeah, it kills everything, right.
And so it's the selective killing that you really care about. And so the next stage is you go into an animal and
a rat.
Actually, usually a so-called nude mouse. This is a mouse that has an immune system that's been compromised, which allows you to implant a tumor, a so-called xenograft. Then you add the drug, and you see if the drug can make the tumor go away. And if the tumor goes away and the mouse is still happy, and it's pretty easy to tell happy mice. Mm-hmm. They're happy because they don't have a tumor. And if they're happy mice, they eat and they make love with other happy mice, and they're just happy. And so it's pretty easy to tell.
So you've got to the point with these little molecules, these little biologics, where you've got happy mice when they once had tumors.
If you have a mouse that has cancer that you dearly love, I can cure it.
Okay.
The next stage of this then is because you've buried the tumor in the hip, you have to figure a way to deliver it to the actual tumor in a human. Which means intravenously or by gavage or one of these feeding methods?
It turns out any of those will work fine. We would usually do intraperitoneal. So you inject under the skin and it slowly diffuses throughout the animal. But it turns out the method of administration doesn't matter very much. It's just easier.
Well, that's only true, though, if the particular drug is pretty ineffective against other cells.
That's correct.
I mean, if you've
got
something which is really potent, do you want to take it straight to the cancer?
Yeah, we're not trying to do that. This is a systemic administration,
right.
Not a target administration.
So have you got into the human part yet? Have you got to the trials?
Yeah, we're now to the point. So you do this with mice, and then you look at other animals to make sure that it's not toxic to pigs and monkeys and rabbits and everything else. And eventually, once you've shown all that, you can go to the Federal Drug Administration and file what's called an IND, an Investigational New Drug Application. And they look at all of your toxicology data and all of your efficacy data and all of the science behind this. And then if all of that is kosher, they will approve you to try the drug in humans. And that's where we are now. We're fairly far along in a phase one trial. We're planning the phase two trial right now.
Where do you get the money to pay for these clinical trials? They're very expensive.
So early on, we had to decide what we wanted to do about this. And I could have simply taken the patents that we had developed, my collaborators and I at Princeton and elsewhere, and simply sold them to a big drug company. And we thought about doing that. And I would have made millions of dollars personally if I had done that. I didn't do that. And the reason was I spoke with friends who were in charge of research and development for very large drug companies. And they said, if you just want to make some money, that's a good idea. Just sell. But if you want to see your drug help somebody, it's a less good idea. Because if we only have a few million dollars invested, when you get to the clinic, you're going to start spending tens of millions of dollars. And your project will be in competition with lots of other people's projects. and there will not be an internal champion for your project. So politically, it may be set aside. There's nothing
put
mean.
On the shelf if they have a competitor. For
if
example,
if there's a competitor, it just may end up on the shelf. So if you really want to see that this has the best chance of helping people, what you're going to have to do is add some value so that when we come in as a big drug company and take this project over, we're paying so much money for it that if it doesn't go forward, somebody gets fired. And that's the political reality. So what had to happen was I had to start a small biotech company, which went through several different name changes for funny reasons, but it's now called Tetralogic Pharmaceuticals. And the sole mission of that company was to put together the resources, the human resources, the financial resources, to get this drug as far into the clinic as it could get and find out whether it could really help people or not.
So you're talking about private investors or
VCs? These are private investors.
Okay.
No, these were actually venture capital groups, some very large venture capital groups. So there's about some total, probably about $50 million has gone into this project so far. So this is not the kind of thing that I could have done with a grant from NSF and NIH. The magnitude of the expenditures is just too large. But it's been very exciting to have the opportunity to see the fundamental work that started out as a bunch of quantum mechanics studies turn into something that we hope will be a significant change in the paradigm for chemotherapy. Because we're not trying to differentially poison cells. We're trying to recognize those cells that have already been primed to die and just help them on to their final reward.
Okay, George, we've only got a few minutes left, but I know you're traveling down to Belize a lot, or Belize, and that's an interesting story for some of our listeners. Just tell us very briefly, what's in Belize that is intriguing you?
We're trying to help the government there change their energy policy in several places in Central America by replacing fossil fuel use that they don't have. And so it's very expensive for them with wind power because they have a lot of wind. There's a lot of wind because where the Atlantic and Pacific come together, they have different temperatures. And the only way they can try and equilibrate those temperatures is with a lot of wind. So I've become involved in trying to help that country through a series of unfortunate events that I'll spare you. I've become involved in trying to help that country build a wind power facility. We're doing similar things in Indonesia and probably in a couple of other Central American countries. That's a stay tuned for more
information.
For more information.
But anyway, the bottom line to it is that you've outlined in this 30 minutes a career that's gone from thinking of yourself as a political scientist, perhaps, a track star, a chemist, a biochemist, now into the pharmaceutical business, and now using your talents to organize to get wind power for Belize. I mean, it's just a fascinating story, and all I can say is well done.
Well, it's been lots of fun, and it was great to have it all start here in your lab.
Well, that's great, too. I'll take the check on the way out. That's it. So, Russ, why don't you say something, and then
yeah,
we'll
please
go.
Come back to Science Studio. It's a fascinating story, and it just seems to me that one of these days you'll be able to make ammonium triiodide by the ton. And thanks to Norma Martinez, our producer.
We thank you out there for listening, and we will be back next week with another Science Studio. Take care. Bye-bye.
Rojas with your Synapse Flash. The El Paso Diabetes Association is having a Night of Hope Valentine's Gala on February 15th. The casino-themed event will honor Dr. Manuel de la Rosa, Regional Dean of the Texas Tech Paul Foster School of Medicine. Call the El Paso Diabetes Association for tickets. Read more at mcasynapse.org. Support for Synapse comes from Kindred Hospital.